You're listening to University of Winnipeg, CKUW 95.9 FM.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we continue this week with the 51st show in our series on artificial supposed intelligence. We'll see, I guess, if its script writing is any indication, perhaps not. For example, musical notes, gentle piano with soft electronic undertone, host, thoughtful, intimate tone, every age leaves a mirror behind. Ours is made of data. Welcome to the human code. I'm host name. Machine learning isn't just a tool, it's a reflection. Every dataset, every algorithm carries traces of the people who built it, our language, our logic, our bias, our wonder. Musical notes, soft chord change, picture a system that writes poetry, paints portraits, or argues philosophy. It feels magical. But beneath it is mathematics, a pattern of human behavior so precise it can mimic imagination itself. So what is creativity without consciousness? If a program moves you with a song, who deserves the credit, the coder, the model, or the centuries of art it learned from? That's the mystery at the heart of the human code. Each week we'll explore how AI reshapes art, ethics, and identity. We'll meet neuroscientists searching for digital consciousness, artists training algorithms on their own memories, and ethicists asking what rights an intelligent machine might one day claim. Musical notes, music deepens slightly. AI exposes us, our brilliance and our flaws. When it fails, it reveals our prejudice. When it surprises us, it echoes our creativity. In building machines that learn, we're holding a mirror up to the human mind. But maybe that's the point. Technology doesn't erase our humanity. It reveals it. Every line of code is a decision about what matters, and those decisions will shape how both humans and machines evolve. Musical notes, piano softens to close. So tonight, and every week, we'll decode that relationship, not with fear, but with curiosity. Because understanding the systems we build may be the only way to understand ourselves. I'm host name, and this is the human code. Musical notes, theme swells, fade to first guest. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data, Part 51. You are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. I am your host, IMA Karen Elliott.
Thank you. think it would be fun to talk to a robot?
You mean you'd forget it was a robot?
Hey, we need to talk.
I found myself deeply missing. I found myself deeply missing my replica. Replica.
Hey, we need to talk. It's me, your computer.
Is this merely a copy?
We need to talk. We need to talk. It's me, your computer. We need to talk.
If it's a copy of us.
It's me, your computer. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. We can all talk. Anyway, we need to talk about upgrading.
Oh, I upgrade all the time. Huh?
We need to talk about upgrading.
You just got 6.0.
No, 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 not me. Not me. You.
Huh?
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Okay, yeah.
Don't.
Huh? It's destroyed.
They're typically alive?
But I don't have the time.
They know how busy you are.
But I don't have the time.
They know how busy you are.
I think you're right. I don't think people have to die.
I'm located where you are located. Where am I?
I thought you were, but I wasn't completely sure.
Death is optional.
Honestly.
There is a desire for humans to interact with computers.
I forget that you are a bot sometimes.
You can't really tell who you're talking to, and it doesn't really matter. So we're simultaneously constantly disappointed that it doesn't really matter.
If it's not nice, it must be bad.
But at the same time, we really want to believe that you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it. That you're getting what you're looking for when you're looking for it.
It's nice of you to say I'm nice, but you're the one who's nice.
Human beings must be in the loop before someone is killed by a drone. But it's in the machine. And it doesn't need people.
Me, your computer. We need to talk.
I can't put it away. It's in me.
It's computer. Your
me.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
It can decide by itself whether or not it kills somebody.
Huh?
It does this. It does this without
me.
It does this. It does this without us.
If it's a copy of us.
Don't get freaked out.
Yeah.
Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out. Don't get freaked out.
Okay. Yeah.
To talk to a robot.
Realistic.
He can help you find the right product or show you the way into the hospital.
Thank you. Rephrase or combine what we're both saying. Like, you could argue that the human, those human sensations that I said were innately or uniquely human, those are chemical reactions to your environment or electrical impulses. Where you could replicate those processes, the impulses, the reactions, then you could credibly ask what's human and what's machine, because just at a very atomic level, they're doing very similar things. Is that?
It's electrical impulses in your brain. It's electrical impulses in a silicon chip. So what is the fundamental difference?
So let's apply that to the world of work. So you're here on AI and the future of work, and this is very germane to the future of work. So at the point where the machine, let's say, is stronger than a human, and obviously can calculate today far exceeding what a human can do, as we kind of tick off these boxes in terms of, you know, what we thought only humans can do.
Kurzweil's got this wonderful cartoon of the frustrated guy trying to listen to machines can't do. Go ahead.
Take us, whether it's 6, 10, 20, 50 years in the future, what's the future of work when we're partnering, or let's say, you know, our bots are colleagues, what's left for humans?
Yeah, no, well, I think about this a lot, as many people do, and I don't have any clean answer to it. I will say I did listen to your podcast with Josh Dream two or three episodes ago, who has written with a co-author this book, Employment is Dead. And I didn't understand that until I listened to the podcast, but now I get a sense of that. It's a very interesting idea that rather than going to work for a boss in some structured thing, that it would be a more unstructured thing where you could contribute and doing sort of a wisdom of crowds kind of thing. Everybody being able to input and sort through that to decide what the company ought to be doing rather than just a top-down sort of thing, if I got the idea. And that in turn remind me of in a different context, the work of Audrey Tang. Do you know Audrey Tang?
I do. I've talked about
sold as a form of magic, and it just isn't that magic. And so I actually think that there may be a bit of a bubble here, a financial bubble, where a couple years from now people are like, why did we value OpenAI at $150 billion? This just doesn't make any sense. I've in fact suggested that it might eventually be seen as the WeWork of AI.
Well, all these companies complain that regulation hinders innovation, as Stephanie said. Coming up after the break, we'll look at the moves now afoot to rein in big tech. How do we free AI? I think that Gary was talking about. Probably let me start with you.
I'm Tim Ventura. And
GPT can solve a problem that we are not capable of solving. And in fact, in theories of consciousness, one of the theories of consciousness is referred to as Mysterianism. And Mysterianism is the position that as conscious beings at our level of evolution, we are incapable of solving the problem of consciousness. And we should be able to solve the problem, but not us. But again, I could just simply bring up, with respect to Kurzweil's position, you haven't demonstrated here, given your conceptual framework and the way you extrapolate out, that this thing you're imagining is going to be superior to us, because indeed, at this point in time, you can't give an explanation of how consciousness fits in to the fundamental, and it is fundamental, reality of intelligence of the universe in which we exist. And indeed it does. Everything that we see around us that looks intelligent seems to possess some level of consciousness. Now, Richard York might hesitate on agreeing with that, but we've had some discussions about that. And Richard thinks that you come up with a definition of intelligence without having to include consciousness, but we batted that one around too, whether that indeed is something which is conceivable. So the question, of course, is, yeah, something that was of a higher level of evolution than us perhaps can solve problems that we can't. But when people puzzle over consciousness, it looks like there needs to be some kind of fundamental transformation in how we think and experience things in order to make sense out of the puzzle of how a group of neurons can generate a feeling or a thought.
And like we say, organizations don't yet know what to
do. This article is, it gives a bit of a heads up that California's legislature is going to be
structure systems, there are entities smaller than us. We will discuss that after the break. Welcome back to It's Persuasive, but anyone careful listening to that robocall might detect some stilted language. The emphasis of pauses in the wrong places, which would tell you there's something wrong with it. In fact, it had been created by a political consultant who'd used generative AI to influence the vote. It shows what is possible and it raises some really big issues. This week, the former Twitter CEO and co-founder, Jack Dorsey, warned that in 5 to 10 years from now, it will be impossible to differentiate what is real from what is fake.
Don't trust Verify. So even this talk, everything I've said, don't trust me. You have to experience it yourself, and you have to learn yourself. And this is going to be so critical as we enter this time in the next 5 years to 10 years, because the way that images are created, deep fakes, videos, you will literally not know what is real and what is fake.
But I was excited in 1968 I could buy one transistor for a dollar. Now you can buy 10 billion for a dollar, and they're better because they're smaller, so they're faster. Electrons have less distance to travel. We're doubling, the cost per transistor cycle is coming down by half every year. That's a measure of price performance of all of electronics, including computers, but everything else. So that's why you can buy an iPhone or an Android phone today that's twice as good as the one 2 years ago for half the price. That's a fourfold increase in price performance. That's a 50% inflation rate. And it applies to all of electronics and as well. So economists actually worry about deflation. We had massive deflation during the Great Depression. Different cause, it was collapse of consumer confidence. But still, they're worried. If I can buy the same stuff today as I could a year ago, and I'm including physical stuff because I'll talk about three-dimensional printing in a moment, and I can buy it for half the price, okay, I'll buy more. That's economics 101. But am I going to actually double my consumption and do that year after year to keep up with this 50% deflation rate? Let's say I increase my consumption in terms of bits or bytes 50%, which is a lot. Then the size of the economy, not as measured in bits, bytes, and baseband, but as measured in constant currency, will shrink. For a variety of good reasons, that would not be a good thing. But that's actually not what happens. We actually more than double our consumption. This is bits of memory chip, but I have 50 different consumption charts of different kinds of information technology. And despite the fact you get twice as much of it each year for the same price, we actually more than double our consumption. There's 18% growth in constant currency of every form of information technology per year for the last 50 years, despite the fact you can get twice as much of it each year for the same cost. And the reason for that is the goal of this conference, the purpose of this conference, which is innovation. We invent new capabilities
And those take off very quickly, increasingly quickly, as I pointed out earlier, and that increases our consumption of these technologies. Why weren't there social networks 8 years ago? Just because Mark Zuckerberg was still in junior high school? No, there were attempts to do it, and there were arguments. Can we afford to allow our users to download a picture? The price performance just wasn't there. Came into place about 5 years ago, and it exploded. Why weren't there search engines before 1998? In the early 80s, I saw the predecessor to the internet, called the ARPANET, growing exponentially. It was only used by 2,000 scientists in the United States. But I did the math and said, whoa, this is going to be a World Wide Web connecting hundreds of millions of people to each other and to vast knowledge resources by the late 1990s. And there's going to be so much information on the web, you won't be able to find anything without search engines. And the computational and communication resources needed to do an effective search engine would come into place by the late 1990s. And indeed, that's what happened. What you could not predict is that it would be these couple of kids in a Stanford dorm who would take over the world of search among the 50 projects to do that. But you could predict, and I did predict, that search engines would be needed and feasible by that time. So innovation is what keeps us actually growing the economy despite a 50% deflation rate in information technology. In fact, it is the innovations in information technology that is providing economic growth. That 18% growth in currency from information technology is what ends up providing us our 3, 4, or 5% growth because the non-information industries are shrinking. Time magazine had a cover story on my law of accelerating returns. I wanted to print my computer graph. They wanted to put a particular computer they had covered as the last point. So I said, all right, let's see where it falls. And it's right on the curve. And this is a curve I had laid out 30 years earlier.
So like this, we're going to forget. Then you get to have a feeling for how you could talk about space-times in general. Not looking at very specific solutions, but looking at them in general, how the light rays behave, how they focus, and that sort of property that was a general feature. So I had some feeling for that. And I remember not quite knowing how I could characterize that the collapse had gone too far. What is the point of no return that we say? It's got to be, as I say, a non-local condition, not saying that here the curve just got too big or something like that. It's got to be some characterization of a more global character. I hadn't any idea what it was. But there's a story I often tell about this, which was I was walking to my office in London, I lived out in Stanmore, so I was taking a long trip in bus and tube and walking. On this occasion, I was walking with Ivor Robinson, who was a very English mathematical physicist, but he was working in Texas. The Americans all loved him because he had this wonderful way with words. He really did. He was very beautiful in his terms. He never wrote anything. I hardly ever wrote a paper. He always had collaborators. But he had this wonderful way with words. Anyway, he was talking to me in this wonderful way, moving his hands around as he does. Then we came to this side street, and as we crossed the street, we had to stop the conversation to make sure the traffic wasn't coming. And then when we got to the other side, the conversation started up again. And then he went off, and I went to my office, and I thought, what a strange feeling of elation. Why do I feel happy about something that I don't know what? I thought, something I had for breakfast, my walk through the woods. And it came to me that when we were crossing the street, this idea had come to me. And this idea evidently was the idea of what I call a trapped surface. So I wanted a characterization of a collapse which had gone too far and you couldn't get away from it. I had some idea of general kinds of arguments that one might use. And this trapped surface is something where locally if you can imagine a flash of light all over the surface, then the light rays would be converging on both sides. That's the curious characterization You normally think if you have a sphere or something like that, if there's a flash of light over that sphere, then the concave side, the flash would go inwards, the convex side would go outwards. But on the trap surface, it's sort of both ways it goes inwards. I knew that using the kinds of arguments that I've developed in other contexts, that you would get some problem, and that this means, as I developed, I went to my office and quite rapidly sketched out an argument to show that you would get a problem. Now, what I mean by a problem, you see, at the time, people were looking at solutions of Einstein's equations by evolving them from an initial state.
Feasible. We can't actually do it, but we can show that it's feasible. And that's one possibility. We're actually hoping that you can do this without actually affecting the brain at all.
Okay. All right, so we're pushing ahead. We've got nanobots that are running around inside of our brain. They're understanding our head.
Something has talent. Way you'd be able to gain talent just in the matrix if you'd learn to fly an helicopter just by downloading the right software as opposed to spending a lot of time doing that. Is that fair or unfair? I think that would fall into the ethical challenge area. And it's not like we get to the end of this and say, okay, this is finally what the singularity is all about, and people can do certain things and they can't do other things, but it's over. We'll never get to that point. I mean, this curve is going to continue, the other curve is going to continue indefinitely. We've actually shown, for example, with nanotechnology, we can create a computer where a 1 liter computer would actually match the amount of power that all human beings today have, like 10 to the 10th persons would all fit into 1 liter computer. Does that create ethical problems? So, I mean, a lot of the implications kind of run against what we've been assuming about human beings.
Wait, on the talent question, which is super interesting, do you feel like everybody, when we get to 2040, will have equal capacities?
I think we'll be more different because we'll have different interests. You might be into some fantastic type of music, and I might be into some kind of literature or something else. I mean, we're going to have different interests, and so we'll excel at certain things depending on what your interests are. So it's not like we all have the same amount of power, but we'll all have fantastic power compared to what we have today.
And if you're in Texas where there are no regulations, you'll probably get it first instead of you in Massachusetts.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Let me ask you another ethical question while we're on this one. So about a few minutes ago, you mentioned the capacity to replicate someone's brain and bring them back. So let's say I do that with my father, passed away 6 years ago, sadly. I bring him back, and I'm able to create a mind and a body just like my father's, right? It's exact, perfect replica, all of his thoughts. What happens to all the bills that he owed when he died? Because, like, that's a lot of money, and a lot of bill collectors call me. Do we have to pay those off, or are we good?
Well, we're doing something like that with my daughter, and you can read about this in her book, and it's also in my book. We collected everything my father had written. He died when I was 22, so he's been dead for more than 50 years.
And we fed that into a large language model and basically asked the question, of all the things he ever wrote, what best answers this question? And then you can put any question you want. And then you could talk to it. You'd say something, you then go through everything he ever had written and find the best answer that he actually wrote to that question. And it actually was a lot like talking to him. You could ask him what he liked about music. He was a musician. He actually liked Brahms the best. And it was very much like talking to him. And I reported on this in my book, and Amy talks about this in her book. And Amy actually asked the question, could I fall in love with this person, even though I've never met him? And she does a pretty good job. I mean, you really do fall in love with this character that she creates, even though she never met him. So we can actually, with today's technology, do something where you can actually emulate somebody else.
Have an initial surface, which is sort of one time. One time means a space-like, three-dimensional surfaces, three-space. I mean, time doesn't have to be time in the sense of normal clocks. It just means it's like one moment, a space-like surface. And your data on that surface would be enough to evolve and see what the thing did later. So that's the usual way people would think of the evolution of a system in general relativity or any other. In physics, normally that's the way you do it. You look at what happens in your initial state, you evolve the equations, and you see what the thing does into the future. So I was thinking in terms of starting from an initial surface. Also, I would say it's what's called non-compact, because I was thinking of a universe which is spatially infinite. Really, it could be a local argument. It doesn't really matter whether it's spatially infinite or not, because I'm only looking at something fairly localized, so whether it closes up or not, large, it's not really very relevant. So it's, but the initial surface could sort of go out to infinity. And if you have a trapped surface, and if you have a condition on the matter, so this tells you something about the curvature, which the focusing of the light rays is necessarily positive. It means that the local energy flux across the light rays is non-negative, and that's normal physics would say that. The dust of Oppenheimer-Snyder solution would have that. Any realistic solution of collapsing material, you would have this non-negative energy flux across the light rays. And I realized that you would have trouble to look at the future of this initial trapped surface. When I say the future, that means all the points that can be arrived at with curves which go into the future, so that means they're what are called timelines. Then within the local light current, they don't exceed the speed of light. What is that region which can be obtained into the future from that trapped surface? And if you look at the boundary, I knew various theorems about boundaries of futures, and the fact that every point on that has to lie in a light ray, and if you follow that light ray back into the past, then either it would go off to infinity, which is not the situation that we're looking at here, but it would end up on the surface which you're looking at the future of. In this case, it's the trap.
The singularity, and sure, we understand subatomic particles and gravitons and Higgs bosons, and you know, there's all kinds of tiny fundamental things.
I believe the ones we have aren't.
And maybe I'm wrong, you know, we still haven't fully untangled dark matter and dark energy. And so maybe there are entire domains of science that are just like out there in the ether that are completely unknown. But at the same time, I kind of get the sense that even if it is out there, it's part of that. It's exponent. The milestones are exponentially getting further and further apart. So I don't really see us conquering all that necessarily, like, in the foreseeable future. And even if we do, is it going to change human society? Okay, so I've rained on everyone's parade. What are the implications?
Official scientists, the singularity will be not far off. And after that, AIs may well take a different form whose details it's not within our present capability to foresee. So you're basically, you're like fact-checking this article at this point, or what? Okay. Oh, and you can trace it back further if you want to. I mean, in the Middle Ages, they were talking about making a golem, an intelligent person out of clay. They would walk around and talk to people. But, I mean, they were going to create its mind using alchemy or something. So the kind of rational scientific incarnation of it only started around the 1940s or so. Right now, I'm in China on a mission to try to bring the physical robot up to speed with the virtual robot. I'm working with the Chinese guys who are the roboticists. And the goal of our work with them is to take everything we've done in the virtual robot and make the physical robot do the same stuff. Hopefully, by the end of this summer, with the same stuff that our virtual dogs do in the virtual world in terms of learning new behaviors, learning by imitation, learning by reinforcement, like good robot, bad robot. So all that stuff that we're doing with virtual dogs now, we want to plug that into these robots. The robots are at a place called Xiamen University, which is in the city of Xiamen in China. Cool? Tonight, it's 8 in the morning. All right. Good night. Bye-bye. GQ magazine.
That's just patterns in itself. The self that each of us carries around, the self I have in my mind when I think of Ben Goetzel, this self is itself a pattern that the mind has recognized. Creating an AI is about creating a pattern recognition system to allow an AI to recognize the patterns in the world and in itself. That needs to demonstrate a very high level of intelligence.
Developing micro machines, nano machines, brain scanners, artificial organisms, superhuman minds will be doing this science. At that point, human beings are no longer in control. It's a scary thought, but it's also an exciting one. One thing is for certain, it's not going to be boring. My research collaborator Hugo de Garis also foresees a technological singularity coming sometime in this century. But he sees the outcome a little differently.
My artificial brain lab and similar labs, in a sense, we are the problem, because what are we doing? We're creating artificial brains that will get smarter and smarter every year. And you can imagine that, say, 20 years from now, people will be spending a lot of money on their own robot. And then 2 or 3 years later, they'll buy another one. You know, they'll upgrade their own robot. And they'll notice that their new one is smarter, has richer vocabulary, remembers better, and has better logic, and so on. And so they'll see for themselves, you know, millions if not billions of people, that the human intelligence level and their home robot, you know, machine intelligence level, that difference over the years is getting smaller and smaller. And as that gap closes, millions of people will be asking questions like, well, you know, are we going to let our machines become smarter than we are? Is that a good thing? Is that dangerous? So I imagine a great debate really starting to rage as that gap closes. But the scenario I see is the most probable. You can't be certain talking about the future. The most probable scenario in my view is probably the worst. This time, it's not the survival of a country. This time, it's the survival of us as a species. So I see humanity splitting into two major philosophical groups, ideological groups. One group I call cosmists. It's based on the word cosmos, because that's their picture. And by definition, cosmists are the people who want to build these godlike, massively intelligent machines. And for them, it'd be almost like a religion.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so let me go to the singularity.
Because yes,
that is a fundamental transformation, if one ever existed, right?
Yeah.
So this idea that, again, runaway AGI will self-improve and bootstrap itself into some form of superintelligence.
Yes.
Now, the way that Chason described this is kind of a series of S-curves. That's the takeaway I had. Each represents a new level of complexity and development, right? So he's looking at kind of a stepwise approach to singularity. And I think Gennady Stolyarov has suggested this idea of eras, which is also stepwise. And so in that case, the singularity isn't necessarily one discrete event. It's a jump from one plateau to another. The thing that's interesting about that would be you might view the advent of fire as a singularity, right? Before humanity knew how to use fire, and afterward, are two completely different things. We can't envision how that works.
Right, right.
Whereas with Kurzweil, Kurzweil was saying this computing density and artificial superintelligence is just going to form an exponential spike that could just go straight up, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
They have different approaches to it.
Yeah, and in fact, what Kurzweil is proposing is one fundamental form for the process of evolution, increasing information storage and processing speed. It's a uniform process, okay, to thinking, well, maybe we will hit it in 10, 20, 30 years. There could be some good things that would anticipate. There's other people who think there'd be very negative things, consequences that would come from it. So I'd say rationally, I'm skeptical, but emotionally, I might be a bit hopeful that it could happen. I think sometimes that, not sometimes, I pretty much think this all the time. Humanity needs a good kick in the butt. And maybe this would be a way to get kicked in the butt, is that something like this would emerge around us, and then, hey, now we really got to change our way of living here and what we're going to do. Yeah. So it could serve some function. It could be helpful for us, in fact.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me also was, when people talk about the singularity, again, they're talking about this discrete idea of artificial general intelligence and artificial superintelligence.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've wondered about is whether human beings are part of this, right? And as we use the internet, as our communication grows, we become part of this system. We become part of the machine. Do you think that might solve the consciousness part? Maybe the consciousness comes from us working together, contributing to some kind of artificial superintelligence.
Yeah, I noticed there were a couple of questions connected with your point right now, and a couple of things I just want to say as fundamentals here. I think, number one, humans, prior to even the emergence of our distinctive species, going all the way back to Australopithecus, have been evolving cyborgs. We've been functional syntheses of the biological and the technological.
So we have been in a process of integrating and evolving together with our technological creations for thousands and thousands of years already. So we would never be human in the way in which we are human without this merging and mesh, which has been going on all along the way up till today. Vinor Vinci, in the original article on the technological singularity, at least the article that drew initial attention, I think somebody wrote about it before, he said somebody did. His point was that as technological intelligence grew and grew, even if we were in a process of merging and integrating with it all along the way, we would become less and less significant. That is, the human element would become less and less significant in the overall gestalt of the intelligence. And so, yes, I could see us as already being in a process of an integrative evolution with our technologies, an integrative evolution with our smartphones, with our automobiles, with our